I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. There's a lot you can learn playing high-stakes poker. Our guest poker champ, Annie Duke, spent many years at the tables making decisions and bets with incomplete information. While she had her share of losing hands, she won over $4 million in tournaments. She writes in her new book, Thinking and Bets, that life is much more like poker than chess because it's a game of uncertainty and some luck. Life, like poker, is hard to predict and oftentimes hard to control. You can make all the right moves and have things go terribly wrong. Duke calls herself an uncertainty evangelist and believes that saying, I don't know or I'm not sure, is more likely to lead to success than being confident, which can lead to closed-mindedness. Annie Duke joins us on Radio Times to talk about what she learned at the poker table, her interest in cognitive and linguistic psychology, how to make better choices. Annie Duke, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And I should add that you retired from professional poker in 2012.
I did.
Tell us, though, why you were good at this game.
So I think that that's an interesting thing. It kind of goes back to something you said in the intro about confidence. So I actually think that confidence is fine. I think that certainty is bad. And I think that the problem is that we conflate the two. So to answer your question, I would have to say, like, I don't think I was particularly good at the game. I think that I navigated the game better than the people that I was playing against.
Meaning that you were able to deal with this uncertainty better?
Yeah, I think that what happens is that particularly with a game that's as complex as poker that has so much hidden information, the cards are all face down, so you don't know what those are, and there's this luck element. So that what happens is that as you're having results happen, it's hidden from view, literally, whether it was because of luck or because of some sort of decision that you made, because you can't see whether it's luck or not. You can't see whether it was your opponent's cards. All of this stuff is hidden from you. So it's just this incredibly complicated problem. And as you learn more about the game, what you learn is that you know less about it. But so I sort of view that as we divide the world into humility in the face of the game you're playing versus humility in the face of the opponents that you're against. And I think that part of the acknowledgement of how incredibly difficult the game is, what comes with that is that you tend to be better at it than the people that you're playing against because you actually see it as a problem that needs to be solved and is really hard. And so I think that you work harder at it.
Well, it's interesting because your book and I guess poker a lot is a mix of skill and luck. And you
yes.
talk about oftentimes drawing the wrong lessons so that if you win a hand, it's because you're really skilled. If you lose, it's bad luck. Those are the kind of wrong lessons to take away.
Yeah, so that's something called self-serving bias. The name is, you know, self-explanatory.
Right.
You're serving your own ego. And we can see this not just at the poker table. So certainly at the poker table, what you would see is when people lost a hand, it was always because they got unlucky. And when they won a hand, it was because they played very well. And that's part of the problem of once you inject uncertainty into the system in the form of luck and hidden information, that outcomes and decisions aren't particularly tied together very well. So because they're sort of loose and pulled apart, we can now interpret them to serve ourselves. And if you think about it, that's not just at a poker table. So for example, when you look at accident reports in two-car accidents, almost 80% of them are reported as the other person's fault.
Oh,
now, obviously, that's mathematically impossible. There's two people in the thing. It must be 50-50 on average. What's really surprising is that in single-car accidents, so only one person has been in the accident, almost 40% of the time it's blamed on something that has to do with luck, something that doesn't have anything to do with you, that isn't your fault.
The slippery road.
Right. You know, the tree jumped in my way. Like literally people will say things like that. So and you know, and you can think about how you interpret, like if you don't get a promotion, it's not your fault. It's like the boss likes the other person more. My kids, when they come home from, school and they have a bad test score, it's not because they didn't study. It's, you know, there was stuff on the test that they didn't know what was going to be on there, that the teacher didn't teach, or the teacher doesn't like them, or it was a really hard test. All these things that have to do with non-skill elements, stuff that we can't control that has to do with luck. And we make these kinds of interpretations throughout our lives, and it's a real problem for learning from our experiences.
What do you do about that? I mean, you're asking us to be very – you're really asking us to be quite rational about making decisions, and we are, in many ways, irrational creatures.
Yeah. So I think the first thing is to recognize that you don't have to be perfect at this to get very far. So the way that I would think about it is, let's say I'm at the poker table,
right. And
naturally – out of 100 opportunities that I have to learn, maybe I'm catching 5. So, like, I'm doing pretty poorly. That's probably naturally about what we're doing. But I work really hard, and I work on strategies in order to be able to be more rational in the way that I'm interpreting my outcomes. So now let's say that I catch 10 instead of 5. You could view that as I'm failing 90%. Of the time, or you could view that as I just doubled my opportunities to learn, which is the way that I like to view it. So the good news is you don't have to get that much better in order to have big effects.
Hmm.
The bad news, and then I'll follow with another piece of good news, is that it's very hard to do on your own. These are incredibly built-in natural cognitive biases in terms of the way that we interpret information. And obviously, experience is necessary for expertise, but it's not sufficient. We need to be able to learn from the experiences that we're having, and we're pretty bad at it on our own.
Hmm. Now, because of our own biases.
Because of our own biases. I mean, I know all of this stuff. You've told me, you know, I've said, okay, now you have self-serving bias, so watch out, because when you have bad things happen to you, you're probably going to say you were unlucky. When you have good things happen, you're probably going to onboard it to skill. Great, I told you that. And you might be thinking, good, I'm cured. And the answer is, no, you're not. In fact, not only are you not cured, but the smarter you are, the less cured you probably are. Because the smarter you are, the better you are at sort of spinning a story that makes that particular interpretation of the world make sense. So here's the good news.
Okay. We're toggling back and forth between good news and bad news.
I'm going to end with good news.
Okay.
I like to end with good news.
Me too.
I think that if you think about it for yourself, and we kind of know this, right, that if someone came to us in a car accident and they just started complaining about how it was the other person's fault, you're pretty good at sort of saying, really? Like, you don't think you did anything wrong there? We're good at catching biases in other people. So that's good news, because mm-hmm. if we're good at catching biases in other people, they're good at catching biases in us. So the good news is you can recruit your friends to help you catch this stuff. And that's the real answer, is if you want to get better and you want to start debiasing the way that you're thinking, have other people help you do it.
Let me pick up on a couple of things. When you talk about, you know, doubling from 5 to 10%, I was thinking about baseball. I mean, a really good baseball player bats about, what, 300, something like that.
That would be really good.
Really
yes.
good. But mostly they strike out.
Yes.
Or get, you know, if someone catches their fly ball, they are out. But a really good player mostly loses.
Yeah.
You think there's a lesson there for us?
Yeah, absolutely. That's the thing, is that in order to have success, you don't have to win every single time. In order to learn, you don't have to catch every single one. Mm-hmm. Because here's the deal with baseball that's true in life. We can think about a competition between old Annie and new Annie, right? So old Annie, who didn't have anybody help her to interpret her outcomes.
This would be Annie Duke, right?
This would be old Annie Duke.
Okay.
You know, who was catching 5% of her mistakes. You know, in competition with new Annie, who got some friends to help her in the learning process and is now catching 10%, you know, new Annie might be failing 90% of the time, but it doesn't matter, because it's how I'm doing against old Annie. So we can think about a baseball player, right? Look, if a 300 baseball player were playing in a league where the average, you know, batting average was 600, they'd be doing very poorly, but they're not. And that's kind of that idea of what I started with, which is there's humility in the face of the game. And then how are you doing at that game in the face of your opponents? So it turns out that hitting a baseball in the major leagues is really hard. And you can recognize that that's a really hard problem, and that you're probably never going to be particularly good at it. The question is, are you better than the people that you're playing against?
Right, right. And that's, what, of course, what makes the difference. I was also thinking as a poker player, but probably when you're at bat and in many things in life, we are by ourselves. I mean, it's a solitary endeavor in a lot of ways. And there's a lot of magical thinking that can happen, you know, where you ascribe certain outcomes because you did X, Y, or Z. Even superstitious behavior is so associated with solitary behavior.
So that's true. And so you might be saying to yourself, okay, but if most of what we do in life is you know, we're making decisions on our own, which is right. True, the majority of decisions that we make by ourselves. You can think about like every single decision you make, just driving to work, for example, right? So the majority of the decisions are on our own. You might be saying like, well, then Annie, how does having other people help you?
Right.
And the answer to that is that there's, if you have other people that you know that you're accountable to for the kinds of decisions that you're making, they will actually help you even when you're on your own because you know that you're going to have to answer to them later. So I give an example in my book, actually, of how this works, how a really good group of people who are helping you with decision making can get in your head in a really good way. In poker, when you're losing, you're usually not a very good judge of why. Mm-hmm. So it can be actually pretty rational to set what's called a loss limit, to say, you know, if I end up losing more than $500, I'm done. The decision's out of my hands. I'm not going to buy back into the game. And it's just a way to stop yourself from emotional decision making. So on my own, I'll probably break that rule a lot. But if I know that I have to go to my group later and explain to them why I lost more than $500, it's actually something that stops me in the moment from making the bad decision. And so this is one of the advantages of group decision making, is that while I'm with you, I can work through my decisions with you, mm-hmm. and I can workshop them. But when I'm away from you, you're in my head.
Like a Greek chorus, right?
Yes.
Standing on the side of the stage.
Exactly.
Telling you what is going on. You made a comment about smart people. I guess what, not knowing their biases or thinking they can explain them away?
So it's kind of a little bit of both. So first of all, Keith Stanovich has shown that people who are smarter actually have bigger blind spots to their own biases. So there's something actually called the I'm not biased bias.
I think I know that bias.
Yes. Smart people have a bigger one of those. And I think the reason is that you sort of think, well, I'm smart and I'm good with data. So obviously I'm very rational and I'm more rational than the average Joe because look at my IQ. And so therefore I'm not biased. And so we can think of the I'm not biased bias as just you have a blind spot to your own biases. Right. But the other reason why, and I think that this will make some real logical sense, is that in order to spin a story that supports your beliefs, that supports the conclusion that you want to get to, you have to be good at spin. So what that means is that you have to be able to tell a story that sounds pretty reasonable to the other person, that's actually cutting, slicing, dicing data, that's analyzing data in a particular way, that's interpreting it in a particular way, that is going to put your story, move your story forward. And you can think that people who are better with information processing and better with data are actually going to be better at those kinds of stories that are more about self-PR than necessarily about truth-seeking. The thing that I say is like, look, if you're going to send someone into the spin room, are you sending in the dumb guy or the smart guy?
We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. That's Annie Duke. She spent many years playing poker, a poker champion, if I can put it that way, clearly the truth. She's also got a new book called Thinking and Bets, Making Smarter Decisions When You Don't Have All the Facts. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Annie Duke. And here she is facing off against Phil Hellmuth. This is 2004 when she plays first in the World Series of Poker Tournament of Champions.
There's the flop, and that is not a bad thing. She flops another full house. Wow.
You need flop insurance against Annie. She's had some great flops, and she will check to try to sucker Phil into a bet.
Phil only has the ace high to go with the two kings on the board.
Check.
He will check. So to the turn, a 10 of diamonds, it's a blank. Annie gets the check mark. She'll only lose if she folds.
And she will have to pull the trigger now. She couldn't get Phil to do her bidding last time. She'll do it herself.
She announces 150,000.
What the heck is going on here?
He can stop it all by folding.
Doesn't seem to be much of a decision here. All he has is ace high.
And after posing, Phil will fold it.
You win.
Actually, she didn't win much, although Phil's acting like he gave away his firstborn.
That is poker on the radio. But Annie Duke, he said an interesting thing to you after he lost to you. He said, I'd prefer to play your brother. He's not as lucky as you are. What was he telling you there?
Well, so here's the really interesting thing. Is that, remember I talked about self-serving bias, right?
Yes.
That, you know, when we get in a car accident, it's never our fault. And when we have great things happen to us, it is always our fault, quote unquote, right? So you might think, okay, so we have this weird information processing for ourselves. Maybe we learn a lot from watching other people, though. After all, other people are doing lots and lots of things around us. They're having lots and lots of results. And if I watch other people do stuff, maybe I can learn a lot from people watching. And the answer is, well, that's kind of interesting because we act like Phil in a head-to-head game in poker, where if Phil is going to interpret his own losses as having to do with bad luck,
right,
what does he have to interpret my win as? Having to do with good luck. And vice versa, if he interprets his winning as having to do with skill, therefore he must have, my losing must have to do with skill as well. That's head-to-head in poker. But we take that kind of thinking out into the world with us. And anybody who we sort of consider in our reference group, meaning people who we might be comparing ourselves to, when they have good results, it's because they got really lucky.
Right.
And when they have bad results, it's because they got in an accident. When somebody that you know gets in a car accident, you're in that, oh, no, that wasn't your fault. You're like, what did you do? You clearly weren't driving well. Were you speeding?
You talk about something called resulting.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, resulting in poker. It was a word used in poker.
It's a word used in poker, and I think it's a very useful word to take out into the world with you. So outside of our reference group, here's the problem that we have. Remember that I said we have this issue, which is you have some sort of outcome, let's say a bad outcome, and you're trying to figure out from that one outcome sort of like what was skill, what was luck, and it's very hard to see into it. In the same sense, if I go into the doctor's office with a cough, it's hard to figure out why. Is it a virus? Is it neurological? Is it bacterial? Is it cancer, pneumonia? We don't know, right? So we have to sort of dig down from this one thing that we can see, which is the bad outcome. And remember, there's this very loose relationship between the two. So resulting is when we act like outcomes in life behave more like chess outcomes than poker outcomes. So we can think about in chess, if we lose a game, it's pretty likely we made some bad decisions in comparison to our opponents. In fact, I'm sure of it. So I can go back and say you lost the game, you must have actually played quite poorly. But in poker, that's pretty unreasonable. And in life, that's a very unreasonable thing to do. To say here's the quality of the outcome, good or bad, and that's going to determine the quality of the decision. And we do that. And when we do that, obviously it's making it harder for us to learn.
Which raises the question about, because I think we all feel like we invest a fair amount of our thinking into making a good decision, thinking there's going to be a good outcome. But you're saying this, there's this element of uncertainty, of luck, of just life that can make what feels like a really good decision end up going nowhere.
Right.
And
the reverse, by the way, you can make some pretty bad decisions and have some good outcomes. So
right.
I can give you like a super example in case anybody's like, oh, what, you know. Here's like the simplest decision, and let's think about how much luck this has. I don't know about you. Have you ever run a red light in your life?
Oh, of course.
Me too.
Sadly.
I happen to have never gotten a ticket doing that.
Right.
Have you ever had
it?
No. Do you think that running red lights is a good decision?
Of course not.
No. So if you're resulting, what would happen is you would get through the red light safely and you would think, great decision, and you would go through and do that. But you can see how much luck is involved in there. If you were playing chess and you ran a red light, you'd just get in an accident. I have also happened to have run a green light and got in an accident before. So I'm perfectly following the rules of the road. I'm making good decisions. I'm doing everything that I'm supposed to do as a driver. And because of something that somebody else does, I get in an accident. So if something as simple as driving through an intersection where the rules are so completely known has that much of a luck element that it's very hard for us to connect together the quality of the outcome with the quality of the decision. I wouldn't do it when we get into anything more complicated than that, which is most of the other decisions that we make. There's a famous example that I refer to in the book where it's the 2015 Super Bowl. And Pete Carroll calls a pass play at the end of the game when there's 26 seconds left and they're down by four. The ball gets intercepted. And the resulting was just resounding. The next day, it was not an argument about whether it was a bad call. It was it the worst call in Super Bowl history or the worst call in football history? That was really what the question was about. Now, we don't need to go into it here, but there's lots of math that suggests that was actually a very reasonable decision. And in fact, Bill Belichick, who was the opposing coach, has actually said that it was a really good decision. But that's a really classic example of the way that we're resulters.
A good decision with a bad outcome.
That was a good decision.
At least for the one team.
It was a good decision with a spectacularly bad outcome, which then made people go back and say it was a spectacularly bad decision.
That's the way humans think, and that's Annie Duke, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. Her book is called Thinking in Bets, Making Smarter Decisions When You Don't Have All the Facts, and she says that life is a heck of a lot more like poker than it is like chess. And again, you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. We've got comments coming in at radiotimes@whyy.org. People are tweeting us at WHYY Radio Times. In fact, a tweet, great guest. Talk to actual people to help understand and improve. What a concept. Such implications for politics. An email for Clyde. What does your brother think about your philosophy and does he follow it? Your brother is also a poker player.
Yeah.
And a tweet from Tabitha. What is Duke's working definition of smart?
So it depends. So in the particular study that was done about smart people being worse at motivated reasoning, they were specifically looking at numeracy.
Oh.
So it was a really great study. So this is a very, you know, I think there's lots and lots of different ways that you can be smart. But this is specifically as it has to do with numbers. So they had people analyze data on skin cream, which they didn't have any particular emotional attachment to or prior beliefs about. I mean, it was just about whether a skin cream was effective or not. So they looked at the people who were better at interpreting that data than the other group, and they divided into two groups, people who are good with data, people who are bad with data. So let's call them smart in a data way. They then substituted in skin cream for gun control, and they substituted in the what was happening with your skin for crime. And they knew whether people were pro-gun control or anti-gun control, and what they found was that both groups interpreted the data to support what their prior belief was about gun control, but that the people who were better with the skin cream data were worse with the gun control data. So because they were better at sort of like explaining the data away, let's put it that way. So that would be smart in that very particular sense in terms of that particular study.
Is that confirmation bias? I mean, does that help us understand why people believe things that are not true?
So it's part of a confirmation bias is part of a larger issue, which is called motivated reasoning.
Right.
So confirmation bias is I believe something, and so then I notice things that confirm my belief, and I tend to not notice things that don't confirm my belief. Motivated reasoning is actually information process that's motivated by the beliefs that you already have, by a conclusion that you already want to draw, by supporting the prior things that you have emotional attachment to. So it not only involves confirmation bias, but it also involves when you are confronted with evidence that disconfirms your belief, you actively work to discredit it, either by criticizing the source or, in the case of the data that they were given, sort of reanalyzing the data to discredit the data, to make the data work for you. This is a huge problem in politics. I mean, when people say, I don't understand, like the information is right there. Why does this person believe this thing that disagrees with me? And it's, well, they have an emotional investment in it. And so just as you do, we all slice and dice the world in order to support what we already believe. And that's why we can't, it's part of the reason why we can't talk to each other anymore.
Because we're right.
Because we're right. And I love that you said that word, because what I try to do is get people to sort of change their mindset, to move away from a desire to be right to a desire to be accurate. Now, I know that sounds like the same thing, but they're not. I view a desire to be right as I have all these very strong beliefs. I predict certain things about the world, and I want those things to be right. I just want to prove what I already believe to be true. accuracy, a focus on accuracy, is saying, I want to construct the most accurate version of the world. And in order to do that, I must view my beliefs as in progress or under construction. I must acknowledge that any prediction that I have has to be uncertain by definition because there's luck involved, right? So if I believe that, then I can now try to construct the most accurate view of the world as opposed to the one that just affirms that the things that I already believed are right. The issue is that we all go around reasoning to prove that we're right.
Of course.
And you can see that so clearly in politics. If we all said, no, let me think, like, well, here's an example. If we just declared something to be right and somebody said to us, well, do you want to bet on it? What does that immediately do? It refocuses us to the accuracy question. Because now we're like, wait, let me think. Do I want to bet on it? I better take out Google. I better go finding. And it makes you actually get into this really interesting mindset, which is instead of asking, why am I right? Mm-hmm. When someone challenges you to a bet, what do you ask yourself? Why am I wrong?
Oh, interesting, because all of a sudden the odds change. But you write in this book that a bet is a form of accountability. I mean, mm-hmm. the decisions are bets, and bets are a form of accountability.
Right. So what happens is that once we say, once I challenge you to a bet, I'm saying I'm going to hold you accountable to this belief. We're going to have some sort of accountability mechanism so that you can't just sort of say these beliefs with no consequences anymore. So I'm imposing a consequence on you for the things that you believe or the things that you might predict. Hmm. So it does act as an accountability mechanism. And we know that once we hold somebody accountable to what they believe, they're much more likely to try to be accurate in that belief. There was a really interesting study that was done actually on academics, which show the power of this kind of accountability mechanism. When they just asked a group of academics, do you think this study will replicate? The academics were in the 50th percent, you know, around 50-ish percent in terms of their accuracy.
50-50?
A little better than 50-50. I mean, I think they were like 55 or 56% in predicting whether whether a study would actually replicate. What was really interesting was that if you made them bet on it, all of a sudden they got up to close to 70%. On their prediction. So it really vastly improved it because what happened was they couldn't just say, yeah, I think it will predict or I don't. I mean, not that they weren't trying, but these biases are so strong that we don't really know we're doing it. So thinking about things as bets actually works as a debiasing mechanism.
That could really change cable TV, wouldn't it?
Well, instead of
just arguing, you're actually betting on whether something is going to happen or not.
Well, you can sort of just think about this for yourself. The next time you go to post some opinion on Twitter, what if you ask yourself, would I be willing to bet on this?
Right.
And that's one of the things that having a really good group can do for you is they can act like people who are sort of betting against you, who can be saying, like, would you be willing to bet on this?
Let me ask you, though, you talk about – it is sometimes hard to talk about things like probabilities and percentages on the radio. But nonetheless, you made a really interesting point about Nate Silver, who predicted that Donald Trump would had a 30% chance of becoming president of the United States. And, of course, he won. And people jumped all over him for being so wrong. You're saying people don't understand probabilities and don't understand what 30% means.
So we tend to – think about things as right or wrong, black or white. So it's kind of 0 or 100%. Maybe there's 50-50, right, which is like the maybe thing.
Right.
But 30% happens a lot. So let me tell you how often 30% happens. 30% he actually had it between 30 and 40%, so let's call it like 35-ish.
Okay.
That's Monday, Tuesday, and half of Wednesday in a week. So my question would be, if you were really, really surprised that Donald Trump won the presidency, you should also ask yourself, am I really surprised when it's Monday? Because that's actually less likely that it just happens to be Monday than that Donald Trump won the presidency. Because he won the presidency Monday, Tuesday, and half of Wednesday. So that's like a concrete way to sort of think about like how surprising should this result have been. I think that the problem is because we do think about things as right and wrong, as black and white, in these terms of certainty, that there was a translation between what people like Nate Silver were saying, which was, it's 70-30, 65-35, versus what the pundits were saying. Because the pundits are sort of serving people's need for certainty, they're feeding this certainty need. And so they're translating it as, well, I'm looking and it's sort of saying like Clinton's, you know, 70%-ish. So when I now talk about that on TV, I'm going to tell people that Clinton is going to win,
right,
because they don't want to be seen as waffling. The problem with that, of course, is that it's setting bad expectations for people. And then all of a sudden the next day, everybody's like, whoa, what happened? And now they're saying Nate Silver was wrong. No, Nate Silver said he was going to win Monday, Tuesday, and half of Wednesday. That's not that surprising.
Is it because we don't understand probabilities, or that's punditry, looking for that kind of certainty?
So I think it's a combination. When you look at what's happened in school curricula, since the 80s, probability has been taught less and less and less and less and less. And I actually personally think that statistics and probability is a much more important thing to teach than, say, trigonometry, which is really useful if you're a sailor or you're erecting a barn. But that's not what a lot of us are doing anymore. And being able to interpret the world and understand what 30% means, right, I think is a lot better. And also, by the way, I think it would be a lot happier if we were teaching that, because when I was looking at those polls, I viscerally know what 35% means. I have lost more poker hands than I can count to somebody who had a 35% chance against me. I'm just kind of used to it. So I was, you know, I was looking at that and I was saying, wow, he has a pretty good chance of winning.
Interesting.
And then what happens is that I think that your decision making is better for it, because now what you're seeing is people saying, well, polls are wrong. And it's like, no, polls weren't wrong. Pundits were maybe not interpreting that data particularly well.
Well, let me just quickly reintroduce you. Actually, let me read an email from Suki. Says, thank you for validating something that I've observed in my very smart, very logical family members. They think they are rational and have a hard time understanding when other people point out gaps in their thinking, sometimes leading to endless arguments, exclamation point. Good to know this is not my imagination. Is that a takeaway we should all have?
I would say that that's definitely a takeaway. You know, it really is true. It's like, I'm good at processing information, so therefore I am not biased. And it's like, no, actually the opposite.
And that's Annie Duke, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. She's talking about what she learned gambling, playing poker. She's got a new book called Thinking in Bets, Making Smarter Decisions When You Don't Have All the Facts. And she says, in many ways, life is like poker. It's hard to predict. It's a game of uncertainty, also a game of luck. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Questions or comments to join the conversation. Also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Do stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoin, talking with Annie Duke. She used to play a championship poker and used to get used to the uncertainty, the high-pressure decision-making that comes with this game. She's taken some of the lessons she's learned from playing at high-stakes tables, along with her graduate studies in cognitive psychology, and applied them to life in general. We've been talking about her new book called Thinking in Bets. Well, Annie Duke was on Celebrity Apprentice back in 2004.
And 2009, here, actually.
2009, sorry about that. And here she is sparring with Joan Rivers.
You know, you are a smart woman. You're not that smart, darling. Your ego is so beyond where you are.
Is ego a big factor in being a championship poker player?
You have to have a lot of confidence. Yes.
Confidence. Ego?
Ego actually gets in the way. You need to have a lot of confidence.
Well, then you're going to fail.
I guess I failed terribly at poker, Joan. You're right.
No,
but I just want to finish one thing.
Go ahead.
I think business is business, and we're in a competition. And
anything goes.
I find it interesting that the personal attacks interest me.
Isn't it amazing?
Well, you know, so many personal attacks to all of us, Annie. You just, I guess you leave them at the door here, and you become so nice.
But you know, Joan, she does seem nice to me. I watched
her
last night. She does seem nice.
So is Hitler and Buchenwald.
That's a scene from Celebrity Apprentice, and that is our guest, Annie Duke, obviously with Donald Trump and Joan Rivers. And it's hard to know what's fake and what's not fake in that episode. But you say an interesting thing about the difference between confidence and ego. And I think that's something we don't necessarily or always understand.
Yeah, so I think that there's – two things that we confuse. You know, we conflate confidence and ego. And I think we also conflate confidence and certainty. So that's kind of going back to what I was referring to there in that, that clip was this idea of ego gets in the way in the sense that when you're trying to feed your ego, then what happens is that you it gets you into that thinking style, which is about being right as opposed to being accurate. And what we can think about is if you already think you know everything, then you no longer are information hungry.
Right.
Right? If I'm already sure, there's no reason for me to go learn anything more about something. And we know that there's lots of hidden information and that our beliefs inform the decisions that we make. So the more accurate our beliefs are, naturally, the better our decisions are going to be. So we always want to be making our beliefs as accurate as possible, which means that we should be very information seeking. And once we bring ego or certainty into the equation, we just kind of stop doing that, number one, for ourselves. And number two, when I express things with a tremendous amount of ego, when I express things with a tremendous amount of confidence and certainty, it's going to stop you from sharing your information with me. So I'm going to sort of be cordoned off from being able to improve the beliefs that I have. So that's kind of what I was saying there, is that ego can really get in the way of being a good poker player, because if you already think you know everything, then you aren't going to try to learn more.
Because I think people, I'm speaking broadly here and including myself, to say, I don't know, I'm not sure, it feels like somehow a weakened position, you know, that I should know, I should be sure.
Yeah. So what I would suggest is I think it's always very important to think about what would it feel like to be on the receiving end of this. So I think that very often when somebody announces something with certainty, I am so sure, you immediately, something in your head is like, oh, come on. You're a little bit dismissive of it. But what if I were to say to you, well, something that was just in the news because of the PA special election. What if I said to you, I think that the Democrats are going to win the Senate because of what's been happening in the special elections. But given the seats that are available and, you know, what the polling is looking like and approval rating, I'm like 43% on that. Now, don't I seem like a very confident person that I'm willing to express that I'm 43%? Don't I seem like I'm very well informed and I'm very thoughtful? Aren't I a really believable communicator if I do that? And what's wonderful about that is I'm also asking you to tell me things that you know. So I'm actually making you feel like a valuable person in the conversation with me, because I'm not telling you a one-sided conversation. This is just going to happen. And I don't really care what you think because I've already decided. I'm saying that I care what your opinion is. So imagine being on the other end of that conversation. And it doesn't mean that I'm not confident. In fact, the willingness to say I'm 43% is a confidence in and of itself. It's a confidence that I am a thoughtful person who has good process and I'm willing to communicate that to you.
Because of uncertainty. I mean, we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. We don't know
right.
what's going to happen in October.
How could I possibly know what's going to happen in the elections in November when we're standing in March? I don't know what's going to happen to the approval ratings. I don't know what's going to happen in the polling in terms of generic ballot. I don't know any of that stuff. So I can make a prediction based on what's happened in the recent special elections that I think that things are sort of swinging one way or the other. But it's still a prediction that has a lot of uncertainty around it. So, you know, 43% is probably too high. I just made that up off the top of my head.
Right.
But, you know, I could have more confidence about the House, for example.
About the House, for example.
Yeah.
Yes. That's, I mean, it's so interesting you say that, because I can't tell you how many conversations I heard said, well, if in Wisconsin they have a Connor Lamb, you know, then he can replicate in that state what happened in Western Pennsylvania, which of course is ridiculous.
Of course, Wisconsin isn't Pennsylvania, and you don't, and they might not have a Saccone or a Saccone. It was Saccone, right?
Saccone, yeah.
They might not have a Saccone running against them. I mean, for example, I mean, people took a lot away from the Doug Jones election, but we know that Moore was really a bad candidate. So had they not had Moore running in that seat, had it been Strange in the first place, obviously it wouldn't have gone that way, and maybe we wouldn't have taken so much out of that. So that's a form of resulting. Mm-hmm. Oh, look, the Democrat won in Alabama. Therefore, that must mean the Democrats are doing much better and that they're going to win, and da, 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 as opposed to saying, well, I don't know. It might have been a combination of luck and skill. There was some luck involved in that Democrat winning. I think that we can certainly say that, right? So we don't want to treat the outcome as too much of a signal first of all, to go in and say that things are a certain way, that mm-hmm. it had to do with some sort of skill element or things that people had control over. And certainly we also don't want to use it as too big a signal for making future predictions.
And there's the things like the weather.
Yes. The weather really matters. That's the thing. Really, if it's snowing.
Do you think men and women make decisions differently?
I do. So I think that the research is pretty strong on this. First of all, women tend to be more risk averse. Yeah. So when you have a choice between an aggressive decision or a conservative decision, women are more likely to be on the conservative side. But again, these are just averages. There are plenty of women who are very, very risk-seeking, who are really good. There are amazing women options traders. There are amazing women risk-takers. There are women race car drivers. So we're just talking about population averages, which you shouldn't take too much from, by the way, because that doesn't tell you where an individual sits on the distribution, just to be clear. The other thing that's kind of interesting is that there is an opposite pattern to self-serving bias, which is instead of saying that good things that happen are because I'm great and bad things that are because of luck, you say good things that happen are because of luck and bad things that happen are because of my fault. That pattern is actually associated with depression.
Uh-huh. I'm not good enough.
Right. I'm not good enough. If something good happens to me, it was just – I just got lucky. But it also happens to be slightly more common in women. Separate and apart from the depression piece. Again, just population averages. You know, the majority of women out there are going to do the exact same thing as men do. So there are some slight differences. I imagine that part of it is just societal, that when we think about adjectives like aggressive, that the valence, when you're thinking about them with a man, tends to be pretty positive, and with a woman, it tends to be pretty negative. And I think that can drive some decision-making differences.
This is speaking in stereotypes here, but I'm wondering whether women are more likely to get their Greek chorus of people around
To
say, you know, that wasn't such a great idea. I mean,
know, but I suspect not. The research is pretty strong that groups tend toward confirmatory style thinking regardless. So we tend to sort of seek out people who are kind of clones of us. And then a lot of the social contract is this, you know, something bad happened to me. I'm sad. Yes, I'm very sad for you too. And I think that that's bad also. Or I express my political opinion and you agree with me. So we tend to drift toward this confirmation. Even when we're sort of trying not to, we tend to drift toward it. Mm-hmm. So I would imagine that there are probably – and again, I haven't looked at the research specifically, but I don't think that there's going to be much difference between women and men on that one.
That is Annie Duke, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And we are talking about living with uncertainty. Let me see what Rick from Warminster has to say. And Rick, go ahead. You are on Radio Times.
Yeah, just a couple of thoughts. I think probably when we make any kind of a decision, whether it's a marriage or a stock market or whatever it may be, it's all about guessing correctly. You're never going to have 100% of all the data, empirical or otherwise, that's going to make you sure you're 100%. Secondly, you never want good to be the victim of perfect. If you've got about 75, 80% of what you're dealing with right there, you need to go with it. There's never going to be a perfect situation. And the final one is when you talk about polls, they can be very subjective and they can also be very much manipulated by who conducts them.
Sure.
Because if you're mm-hmm. calling on a landline and you're calling at 10 o'clock in the morning, you're probably going to get somebody who's either retired or unemployed. And so perhaps their information, true as it may be to them, may not be reflective of the information that you're trying to provide through the media, that this is going to be a bellwether of what's out there.
Rick, I appreciate
those are my thoughts.
Those are three good thoughts.
Let me address them backwards. I agree with you about the polling, which is why I think Nate Silver is such a good resource, because he actually grades the polls. from A plus to D. So he's taking into account exactly the kinds of issues that you're addressing as he's modeling what the polling data is telling you. So I think it's not good enough to just look at a single poll because you actually don't know those things. Luckily, we have Nate Silver who does know those things and actually
rates
them.
You're a Nate Silver fan.
I am a Nate Silver fan. So I can actually address points one and two, which were amazing. Thank you, Rick. One of the things that people ask me actually is when you start to approach the world from the standpoint of uncertainty, doesn't it cause you to be paralyzed in your decisions? Because don't you need to know that you're certain in order to make a decision? But what Rick brought up is exactly that the opposite is true. Once you embrace that there's hidden information and that there's luck involved and that you can never get to perfection, it allows you to go ahead and put it in the gun when you think that you've got it, you know, you've kind of got enough information. And it's about being a good estimator of when the incremental information that you might sort of accrue is probably not going to move your decision that much. So as Rick said, like, okay, I've got 80% of what I need. The extra 20% probably isn't going to be that helpful. I should go ahead and do it. And once you understand that no matter what you decide, that there's luck involved, you can have a one percenter come in and have it be a disastrous result as the ball gets intercepted in the end zone. It makes you much more willing to go ahead and try. So I think that that's a little bit counterintuitive, but Rick brought up the point in a beautiful way. So thank you.
Yeah, Rick, thanks for calling into Radio Times. I'm also thinking about just how gut, you know, that feeling, how much that plays into our decision making. And I'm thinking of all the big and small decisions that we make. And even when you were playing poker, as you said, you had incomplete information. At some point, you just have to go with what feels right or what the instinct tells you or what the chemistry is around the table.
So thank you for that question. That's actually a really good question. And it's one of the, you know, it's definitely something that social psychologists grapple with is where does intuition or gut come into play? So first of all, let me just say, if you have a decision where it's better not to think, go ahead and do that. So if you're driving and you see a deer running in front of you, I hope you go with your gut. Please don't analyze the decision. Just steer away. If you're a fireman and there's a burning building and you have to make a split-second decision about whether you should run in or not, it's probably good to go with your gut. That being said, what we really want to do is make sure that our gut is also held accountable to some sort of reasonable process later. So the way that I view gut is you have the whole of your experience and knowledge that are coming down in some kind of automatic way, in some kind of reflexive way to inform your decision. And that's totally fine because in the moment we need to do that a lot. For a lot of our decisions, we just don't have the time to draw out a decision tree. But later on, hold that accountable to a rational process. One of the things that I found with poker was that when I started teaching poker seminars, my game started changing immensely. And the reason why was that things that I had been doing by my gut that I just sort of assumed were right, when I found out that I could not properly teach it or express it to another human being such that they could also execute the decision, I realized, maybe in this case my gut is wrong. And I went in and sort of recalibrated. So as long as you're holding your gut accountable, then your gut will get better and better as it gets more informed. The thing I don't want anybody to ever do is when they're in a discussion with someone and they're trying to justify a decision or an action that they've either taken in the past or that they're thinking about taking, never ever say, well, my gut told me, as if that's a satisfactory answer. Your gut can often be right, but that doesn't mean that it shouldn't be accountable.
Do you miss playing high-stakes poker? You left essentially in 2012.
You know what? I don't really. I mean, I played for 20 years. I played for a very long time. Loved the game.
For all the reasons that we were just talking about.
But at some point, in 2002, I started doing this teaching, which developed into this book, which was really taking my academic background from UPenn in cognitive science and merging it with this natural lab that I had been sitting in poker and starting to teach. And honestly, I rediscovered this incredible joy of teaching, which I had done earlier in my life before I started playing poker. And I really, really, really loved it. It was a wonderful, wonderful time. But I love what I'm doing now.
Annie Duke, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. And her book is called Thinking in Bets, Making Smarter Decisions When You Don't Have All the Facts. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. We did post a little video of Annie Duke and me talking before the show went on the air. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you for joining us.